This is Marginalia, a production of KMUW Wichita.
Marginalia. Notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental
or additional to
the main topic in the margin of a book.
I'm Beth Golay, and this is Marginalia. In today's podcast, I visited with Josh Barkin about his new book of stories, Mexico. He has divided his time between the United States and Mexico for several years, and many of these stories were derived from personal experience, as Josh explains in our conversation. Here he is.
Well, I definitely was inspired by a couple of events that happened to me in quick succession. And I should say before I go into that, that there are many wonderful sides of Mexico. And of course, I'm going to be talking about some of the violence, but we all know there are many other things. Wonderful food, museums, etc. In terms of the experiences that happened to me directly, two things happened. I was in a taqueria in Mexico City, in the south of the city, with my wife one day. This was a kind of upscale taco place and a place where upper middle class people tend to go. Three men came running backwards who had guns drawn. They were running out on the street, and we were kind of on a curve in the street. It looked like these men were literally going to run back towards us, into us. And as we were there, two men came out kind of dressed security guard, Kojak style, bald aviator sunglasses, wearing suits, ties, and they had Glock 9 guns, and they were pointing it at these three other people and shooting as they ran. We got down on the ground. I pulled my wife down on the ground. We quickly moved. We were kind of told by this local cop to move back behind the counter of the where the cooking was taking place. We went back into the kitchen. This woman, who was in her late 60s, I would say, was kind of on the ground, very nervous, shaking. I was trying to comfort her. And we really didn't know at that point. There was this kind of silence. We didn't know, were these gunmen going to come into the place that we were in because of the curve on the street? And so there's that moment where you just don't know what's going to happen in your future. And then it turns out they kept running down the street, and there was the continued shooting, and I believe that some of them were shot. This was a very, you know, very powerful moment, this kind of nervous laughter as we all came out. And as I remember, as I was going out there, I asked someone, you know, who was it? And they said, oh, es nada, son unos rateros, it's just some pickpockets. But it wasn't some pickpockets. It was some people who probably had been going into a fancy restaurant and had tried to, from what we can tell, do a hit job on a kind of rich businessman. And then the two guards of this businessman were the ones who went shooting after them. So that was one experience. And then that same week, then my wife, who's a painter, and a very good friend of hers who's a painter, his first cousin, an architect in Mexico City, had been down in Zihuatanejo, which is a kind of somewhat resort town on the Pacific coast of Mexico. And he ended up being shot and killed. He was a well-known architect in Mexico. He had been designing a house probably for, or somehow involved in a project for, someone who might have been a narco, and as a result got caught up in this completely coincidentally. He had no idea what was happening, and then he was killed. And so these two things, I remember the funeral for that person. I went to the funeral. It was quite a few elite people in Mexico there. For example, you had Vicente Fox, the former president of Mexico. This was in a church in Santa Fe, which is part of Mexico City, a very contemporary church, and the priest was up there giving his eulogy, and he was saying that this was God's will, that it had all been God's will that this had happened. And I couldn't believe that. I couldn't accept that. And so I think the combination of those two events made me want to write about the violence that was taking place in Mexico. Up until that point, I had felt this was a subject that had been covered well, perhaps by journalists such as Charles Bowden. But it seemed to me that there was an important missing story, which was the story of people such as painters, architects, chefs. These are the types of characters that have taken place in the book Mexico. Beauty queen, however, people who we don't normally think of, in other words, not people who are directly involved in the drug trafficking or users of drugs, but people who are kind of incidentally being affected by some of the violence. And so it seemed to me essential to write the book.
I know these are fiction, but I was wondering how much truth was behind the fiction and if any were biographical. So your wife's friend, the architect, was that what you based the story Acapulco on?
Well, I should say that that story, the Acapulco, what happens there, there is an architect, and he does end up in, he ends up going to some strip clubs, and then with someone who ends up being a narco, which is not the case in the real story. There was no strip club or anything like that. But what I'm interested in, for example, in that story in particular, it's the ambition of the protagonist, who's this architect. His father is a well-known architect, but he's fairly well-known. He's a decent architect, the protagonist, but he's not famous, and so he needs to reach out to kind of any client he can get. And so he's put in touch through a kind of friend of a friend of a friend, in touch with someone who has the money to build a $4 million home. And he's trying to figure out how low is he willing to go to kind of realize his dreams of doing better in his profession. And so he ends up going to these strip clubs. He ends up and ultimately even doing some kind of lewd things just to satisfy the kind of narco that he's with, who humiliates him somewhat, but just so that his ambition can kind of play out. And so by the end of the story, he's made aware of that kind of ambition that's too much. So what I'm saying is that I start sometimes there are stories that start out of some kind of personal experience, but then they move very much beyond that because I'm interested in the kind of personal problems of the character. For example, in this case, the ambition of that character, rather than just the literal violence. This isn't just a book about crime, for sure.
You know, I noticed that most of the stories were told by characters who were Americans but living in Mexico. Do you think you're more comfortable with that perspective?
Yes, I mean, inevitably, whenever you start dealing with cross-cultural writing where you're setting stories in some other country, the question comes up, what license do you have to be writing in that other country? So there are a couple of stories that take place in which the protagonist is from Mexico, and there is no kind of American element in the story. But in most of the stories, there are 12 stories. And in most of the stories, the protagonist is an American. I think it's because it came out of my own comfortable, the kind of knowledge that I had. Just, I lived in Mexico for 2 years. My wife's from Mexico. I've been down there 7 years, going back and forth, spending, say, 3-4 months a year down there ever since I moved back from those 2 years that I lived there. So I felt very comfortable writing about the expat community that was living down there. And one of the things that many people don't know, we're so focused now on you know, immigration to the United States, but there are 1 million Americans living down in Mexico, and these aren't just elderly people. These are all sorts of different people, including painters, chefs, people like that. So that is one of the reasons that some of these stories have so many American characters. But the other thing is that outsider perspective, I think, sometimes gives us a chance to do a kind of fusion, see things that might not be seen locally. Or I think, for example, again, I don't think a typical journalist in Mexico who was Mexican would be writing about the kinds of people being caught up in the violence that, say, are of a different kind of more elevated socioeconomic class.
You know, and you mentioned that, you know, one of the underlying currents of these stories was violence, specifically drug-related violence. But it also seemed that, you know, when you would come to the end of the story, the narrator would come to their own conclusion or understanding or resetting of their own perspective on life, maybe.
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. And I think one of the reasons it's the case, so in other words, what you're getting at is there's a kind of optimistic ending in many cases to many of the stories, and it's not because there's any optimism about the type of violence that may be taking place or is taking place in Mexico, but it's more, again, I'm interested in the personal problems a character might face. So if we take a story like I Want to Live, one of the stories in which a woman from Cleveland who had been a nurse and who's about to get a double mastectomy because she's been identified as having a likelihood of breast cancer if she doesn't get her breasts removed, she is faced with this very difficult situation of trying to make that decision, what to do in the face of this kind of diagnosis. And she encounters someone while she's in the waiting room for, as she's gone to a kind of recovery doctor to see what the options would be. And she meets a woman who had been a beauty queen, and this beauty queen, who had been an orphan growing up, had become involved with, actually married eventually to one of the narcos who became quite big and rose up. And this beauty queen, slowly, she rises in her career as well, and she ends up feeling in some ways that she attaches herself too much to this narco and at some point ends up defending him when he's caught up in some of this violence. But by the end of the story, what the protagonist realizes is that this beauty queen has found a way to find a means of finding the beauty of life, even though she has scars on her body, to find the beauty to even go back to work in an orphanage after her husband is killed. And she finds in that beauty a way to confront her own fears. So that's one of the kind of examples where someone can find some strength out of the suffering of, say, someone else. Or in other stories, you have a story such as the kidnapping. You have a character who's a painter in Mexico City, and he's someone who is full of life, but he's someone who tends to kind of, as he says, it's almost like he's rolling like a stone, and he's someone who is always kind of seeking a way, not seeking stability in his life, and he reflects when he's kidnapped. He starts to think about his relationship with his girlfriend, in which his girlfriend had also been using some drugs, and he cheated on her when he went on a trip to Cuba. And while he's cheating on her, he then realizes when he's been kidnapped, he realizes the way in which he's mistreated his girlfriend and the way in which he's been avoiding kind of setting roots down. So over the course of confronting that life or death situation in a kidnapping, he's able to reflect on the way he's treated others badly, mainly his girlfriend, and then to find a way to improve himself. And that happens in a number of the stories, that sense of discovering what's essential in life because you're faced with a life or death type situation.
You know, back to I Want to Live, the woman who was facing the inevitable breast cancer, she kept wanting the woman who was scarred to tell her story and to tell how she had gone. I mean, she was clearly so beautiful, but she had scars on her. And she kept insisting that she would tell the story. And the beauty, she said something about how I can see you're not from here, or else you wouldn't insist this of me. Is there a perception of, you know, as Americans, that we tend to want to know too much, that we're not entitled to know the story?
I think it's interesting what you're bringing up there. It's kind of levels of privacy and how much should remain private and not. And in that particular story, as you're mentioning, the beauty queen who is in the waiting room with the other, the nurse from the United States, is reluctant to describe her scars and what the origin of her scars is. In part, I think it's the particular character that she is reluctant to describe the painful experience she's gone through in getting the scars. But when she makes that comment that you mentioned, it is that notion of what's public, private. And there's very much a sense, things are different, right, in Mexico, and in the sense that family is extremely close, extremely, perhaps even tighter as a unit than, say, your typical American family, although obviously we have many Latinos and Latinas in the United States where that's the case. So the book does capture some of those kinds of cultural differences, a notion of what can be confessed, what's public, what's private in some of the stories. And you see that coming out because there is this mix of characters that are both from the United States and from Mexico.
You know, I want to talk about one more story. Part of The Sharpshooter is set in Kansas, specifically Wichita. And was that location specific to the story from the time you spent here, or was it just convenient? I mean, did you have any interaction with people who were who had gone through ROTC and had joined the Marines?
Yeah, that story, it takes place, the protagonist of that particular story is someone who is a sharpshooter down in Mexico, sent by the United States government, and he's involved in sting operations, and he ends up he has 39 kills, and he ends up with his friend, who is also from Wichita, and both of them have gone through ROTC. And while they're down there, his friend, the protagonist's friend, Charlie, ends up turning bad, ends up being corrupt, and ends up being bought off by a group of kind of narcos. And it's only slowly dawns on our protagonist that that's the case. But they're in a sting operation, and as he's in the sting operation, he's ordered by a colonel who's taken over the operation, who thinks it might be compromised, to ultimately shoot his friend because it's revealed that the friend, Charlie, has kind of been ratting and is a mole. And so the question is he going to do it or not? I won't give the answer because otherwise it gives away the whole story. But the question then about whether it just was conveniently in Wichita, I used to teach at Wichita State University, and I had one student, and the student was someone who was dyslexic and was someone who I knew had been in ROTC. That's all I know about the person. Certainly he never was a sharpshooter as far as I know, and certainly never went down to Mexico. But out of that experience of imagining someone who was truly kind of good in so many ways, the student I had, I remember being tremendously impressed with his interest in literature. And I remember him not wanting to, for example, take more time to do his exams, and yet at the same time feeling that he did need to take some more time in those exams. And so he was torn because he wanted so much to do what he always considered the right thing. So I imagine in that story, what if you're placed in a situation where you're kind of ordered to do something that you know is wrong? That is, even if your friend has compromised a mission, can you follow an order that is that you know to be illegal, that you know to be wrong in terms of kind of shooting at him, even though you've been ordered to do so? And so he comes back to Wichita at the end of the story, and he, with this tremendous sense of remorse, but slowly it comes, he starts to question everything. He starts to question everything from the kind of be-all-you-can-be motto that he had felt he had grown up with, starts to question his father's upbringing. He on the one hand, respects his father quite a bit, but sees his father as compromising notions of truth in terms of the way that the father discusses things that he feels are kind of politically based. And so as a result, the protagonist ultimately has to face those kinds of lies, and he has to find his own personal truth. And he finds that in a moment in a pawn shop in Wichita, which is a moment in which he sees his own reflection. He's trying to sell a medal. He's received a medal that for all of these kind of kills, but in some ways he's been kind of bought off with this medal. Just to kind of get rid of him after this mission went bad. And so he sees his reflection and he realizes the disparity between who he had been initially with these kinds of bright, hopeful ideas about what it would be like to be a soldier, and then the reality of what he faced down in Mexico and what happened to his friend Charlie, who ultimately did die. So it came out of I think it was very essential having that experience in Wichita. I mean, I remember so many positive things about Wichita, but I also remember the numerous pawn shops and the kinds of I would go to those pawn shops sometimes just because I was looking for something cheap myself. But while being there, you can't help but notice sometimes in pawn shops the kind of lost dreams. You know, the person who sells the ring, the person who sells the medal, the person who sells something that you know had some value to them, but that they no longer, for some reason, they got rid of it. And what is that reason? And so that kind of comes into the story, and it becomes essential to it as well. So I'm always absorbing the places I've lived. You know, if I've lived in New York City, and so then I find myself now writing a novel that's set in New York City. But sometimes it comes later, a couple of years afterwards.
You know, it was your perception of the pawn shop that kind of made me stop and pause, because I've gone into pawn shops before, and when you were looking at the items, or your character was looking at the items and seeing the loss, I had a different perspective, because I would go into pawn shops to try to recover things that had been stolen from my home. Because we were told by the police that they'll try to offload whatever they stole from you at a pawn shop. So I could appreciate what you were trying to say about all of the lost dreams, It's helping me, because I just assumed that the pawn shops were full of all, you know, stolen items from.
Well,
from
I mean,
homes.
One of the things I was noticing, for example, and I don't think you can help but notice it if you live in Wichita for a while, is obviously there's the amazing aircraft industry, but there's also increasingly fewer and fewer jobs in that industry. Some of that because some of the jobs have gone to places like China. Some of it just because, you know, some of the construction has gone to other parts of the country. But you're aware, and I would talk to people who had been students of mine who had been from Wichita, who were in their 80s, and they would tell me about the 1950s and everyone going around with their Harley Davidson and people going around with their power boats and so-called working class or middle class people who were earning quite a bit of money. And then you can't help, when you go into some of these pawn shops, to see people getting rid of weed whackers, people getting rid of lawnmowers, people getting rid of things that, those are the things where you say, okay, those objects may just be getting old. But what really struck me when I would go into a pawn shop sometimes in Wichita is I would see really good tools. I'd see amazing tools, tools of professional people, tools of people who clearly had been working their whole life in doing those professions. And again, it's that kind of sense of a lost dream. So that was one of the things I was looking at in that story.
I did like when you would talk about the different things, you know, we have the box stores and, you know, things like that. But I also liked when you put was it Hogwild Barbecue? I mean, you put some local stuff in there, too. But one thing that you might not, I'm not sure if this would have happened before you left or not, but you mentioned the golf course at WSU when they were doing like a training run on it or something.
Right.
And that's gone.
Sure. No, I mean, right when I was leaving, that was going to be the innovation campus, and that was definitely something that was more than in the works. At the time that I was teaching at Wichita State, there very much was the golf course there, and you could just see sometimes the heat. This is that same story with the sharpshooter when the protagonist is in ROTC and he's going to Wichita State, and it's this hot day, and he's training. And while he's training, it shows the friendship he has with his friend. He breaks down in the heat someday, and he kind of sees these golf balls being lobbed down the golf course there. But I guess that scene could never happen anymore.
How long have you been working on these stories?
Well, it took a couple years to write them, and all of them were really written while I was at Wichita State or just before. So it was a combination of while I was there and during the summers when I was teaching at Wichita State. And I would find myself going back and forth every summer to Mexico, sometimes even with the support of a grant from Wichita State that the deans gave me one time. So these stories really came out, of that period in my life about 3-4 years ago in terms of the writing.
Now, you have two other published books. One is a novel and one is a book of stories. How are the processes different for both writing and publishing these two different types of genres, I guess?
Well, one thing about short stories is that often, at least commercially, they don't sell that well. That's changing, or there are different waves. Some people, of course, really, really love short stories, and I think there may be a new renaissance happening this year in the sense that we have a number of very strong short story collections coming out. Generally, in the publishing business, there's a desire to put out novels. In terms of my own experience with my current publisher, which is, again, Hogarth and Penguin, which is part of Penguin Random House, they couldn't be more supportive. And I think it's been an extremely collaborative process on everything from the book cover to editing the stories. I have a young editor who I think is really very bright and good at kind of catching things that can be improved in the story. So each experience really depends on kind of how big the press is and how commercial. This is a big press, clearly coming out with Penguin Random House, but I've had earlier collections that have come out with, say, Northwestern University Press for the novel. So that can make the biggest difference more than anything.
I was going to talk to you about, readers gravitating toward novels over short stories. And I think short stories are making a bit of a comeback recently. And I actually love reading short stories. But why do you think they're such a difficult hand sell for booksellers?
Well, I think that what readers do like about novels is that feeling that they can really latch onto one particular character, the protagonist, and kind of be with them for a long time and get to know the character. And then there's also that space for digression, and you can kind of move into a whole world for a long time in a novel. So that's some of the appeal of the novel, I think, for readers. But I think what people are finding with short stories, especially as people have less time often to read, or they're feeling they have less time, is short stories give you that chance to kind of quite quickly or have a very profound experience, something almost like an intensification of flavor. In a kind of short 20 pages, say, or 30 pages, and also over the course of a collection, if you have one such as this collection, Mexico, many of the stories set in Mexico City, although some are in nearby areas, Puebla or Sinaloa, you can get that same sense of space. You may not be with the protagonist the whole time, but you get kind of a series of epiphanies rather than, say, one kind of epiphany or understanding that comes at the end sometimes of a novel. So I like to liken it between the difference between sprints and marathons. And it's true that short stories are more like sprints. You don't necessarily have as much time sometimes to go into the interior consciousness of your characters. But I think one of the things that is very important to me and perhaps sets some of my stories apart from your typical short story writers. I'm very interested in the interior consciousness. So I'm very interested in not just the action that takes place. Short stories tend to be more action-oriented or plot-oriented. But I'm very interested in what's my character thinking in any moment? How are they trying to get out of their dilemma? What are they thinking about how they got in this particular situation to begin with? It's like I was saying in that story, the kidnapping, is the protagonist is reflecting upon his relationship with his girlfriend as he's there. Or if you have a story called The Prison Breakout, and in that story, the protagonist ends up, he's a journalist, he's an American journalist, but he and lives down in Mexico. But he also, to kind of make ends meet, he has been working with death row inmates in the United States, inmates who have come from Mexico, and the government looks for mitigating circumstances to see if there's any cause for a kind of lessening of sentence or if information or evidence has been improper. And so he ends up meeting, though, a prisoner who's in Mexico, who they don't have the death penalty there in Mexico. But he ends up meeting this character, and as he's investigating the situation of the character, he realizes that this character, who's a mime, is someone who's been completely falsely accused, someone who could not have possibly committed the crime that has put him in prison for life. And this mime, the only reason he's there is because two people who'd robbed a bank were signing in sign language, and they rode off on BMX bicycles. And this particular mime happens to also have a BMX bicycle and be deaf. But in no other way is he at all like the people who committed this crime. He's short, they were tall, and everything else is completely different. So one of the things that I'm interested in, though, there is that the protagonist at that point, he's thinking, how is it that he comes around to the idea that rather than just looking to kind of defend the rights of people who are in prison incorrectly, he ultimately helps this one prisoner to escape. And so I'm interested in that thought process. How do you come around to that? How do you come to the idea that, say, working within the system, in the judicial system, is not the way that you should try and help this prisoner? Is there something else you should do? And in this case, actually helping the prisoner to escape by bringing in a file. So those are the kinds of things that frequently people might think that interior consciousness is primarily in novels in longer form. But I see it coming in very much in the short story if you give it space.
Well, and how was it that you were able to pack such a powerful punch in such a short, such a short amount of space? Like you were saying, some of these are 20, 30, 40 pages, but they were so powerful and rich.
You know, I think it really is figuring out the perspective of your character, really putting yourself in their mind. And that's one of the ways that I think you can get that sense of power. But the other thing is, I'm very interested in stories in which there's a moral choice and where the character may have to, for example, if you think of that story that I just mentioned with the prison breakout, in some ways there's a dilemma, right? If you are someone who believes in the judicial system, then you want to follow the law. And yet at the same time, here's someone who the judicial system has completely wronged, and you know it to be completely wrong. And so you want to help that person, or they're going to be behind bars forever. And within the context of the judicial system in Mexico, this protagonist decides there's no way to appeal that. So placed in that kind of dilemma, he has to make a very difficult decision. Is he going to help this person? And over in these stories, you see the protagonist having to make that kind of difficult decision. There's a story called The God of Common Names, and I think it's one of the more unusual stories in the collection. The protagonist of that story is an American who's gone down to Mexico just kind of traveling, and he's a teacher. And when he gets down to Mexico, he falls in love with this woman who's part of the Jewish community in Mexico, and he didn't even realize there was a big Jewish community in Mexico City, and there are 20,000 Jews living in Mexico City. And so then it kind of flashes forward to this point, or the beginning of the story, where he's teaching his classroom 10th graders. And it turns out he has two students who are not really paying very much attention, but they're very much in love. And it's a kind of Romeo and Juliet story. And the father of one of these two people who is in love comes into the classroom, threatens the teacher. He has to separate these two students. And we discover that the two students have parents who are rival narcos, and they're in this kind of illicit business. And so the protagonist then at that point ends up in a kind of parallel situation in which he had fallen in love with his wife, who was Orthodox Jewish. He himself is fairly secular. He's not completely an atheist, but he doesn't really believe in God. And at the point that he was going to marry his wife, the father of the bride feels that he shouldn't be able to marry his daughter because he's not religious. So the father completely disowns the daughter and separates himself from the couple. So as the story goes on, the protagonist has to decide what's his relationship going to be with his father, who his wife is estranged from. Is he going to ever find any way to patch up this kind of strong breaking within his own family? And as he follows the story of the two students who are being kept apart in this Romeo and Juliet manner, and trying to help them to stay together or at least to be safe, he begins to realize how can he also help his own relationship with his wife. And he's placed in that difficult moral choice then ultimately. The father wants the protagonist to give up his own, to profess a faith that he does not necessarily really have, and he has to decide, am I willing to do that so that I can keep this family together? So what I'm getting at is those difficult, if it sounds long in describing it, it's because it's a complex moral decision. You know, what are you willing to do to ameliorate the relationship in your family? And so over and over again in these stories, in a very compact story, we see the characters having to make these tough moral decisions. And I think that's what gives them the power.
Well, it's a great collection. I really loved it. I don't know if you know, you rode the bus with me every day for a few weeks now, and I was able to, you know, finish one story while I was riding the bus, and well, it was just beautiful.
Well, that's really an honor. I mean, I feel like that's always what you want, you know, to have the reader take you, say, on that public transport or read you. I have friends who have read drafts on their iPhones in the New York subway. And I think if you can have that relationship, that intimate relationship with the reader, where the reader can block out for a while, you know, I'm no longer on the bus in Wichita or in the subway in New York. I'm in Mexico now. I'm with these characters. I'm in these kind of vibrant places. And that really is the pleasure when you connect with the reader, who you may, you know, will almost inevitably never know unless you meet those people at a reading. But it's that pleasure of connecting on the page.
That was Josh Barkin, author of the new book of stories titled Mexico, which was published by Hogarth. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. Discover new episodes at kmuw.org or through iTunes. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita. Our editor is Luann Stevens. Our engineer is John Cyphers. And I am the producer. This is Marginalia. And for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.